Here at the podcast over the years, we've learned a lot from our winemaker friends in Napa. And remember when Dorothy Chelichev visited and told us about Andre's generosity with information and those times he'd fall into the tanks?
He had lots of friends in France, and they always talked wine. I mean, but it was nothing that he ever really worked in, and I billed somebody for it. That was friendly.
But he used to give away information freely.
He never withheld anything. He shared it with everybody. And that was one thing that was hard for him when he came here, because when he came to the valley, there was this secrecy. Don't tell the next guy what you're doing. And that was a little hard for him to break through. But he always was that way. People would call him at the house and ask for information, or he'd come to the visit, and he was always willing to talk about the wine or their problems or what could be done. And when Andre started his consulting, of course, he started up at places like Nibom Coppola. He walked into that and he said, "This is Beaulieu when I came. This is the way it was, the old big tanks up there." And he used to get up on the top of the tank and listen to it or smell it. It was his thing to climb the ladder and get on top of the tank and go from tank to tank hopping. And Steve Baranzini, who was the winemaker there, said, "Mrs. T, I can't tell you how many times I had to fish Andre out from the tanks because he fell down."
Well, recently we called up some of our sommelier friends to see what really gets them excited about Napa Valley wines. For a limited time, a bunch of them are cherry-picking some of their favorite Napa Valley wines and pairing them with the specialty burgers at their restaurants. The idea, called Somms and Sliders, brings two great things together: passion for wine and delicious burgers. John Reagan from Union Square Hospitality Group really fell in love with Napa wines from the 70s and 80s.
This is John Reagan, Master Sommelier at Union Square Hospitality Group. We've partnered with Napa Valley Vintners to pour some great Napa wines with great versions of burgers throughout many of our restaurants. When I first fell in love with wine, I visited Napa Valley, and I loved it so much I didn't move back. That was back in the day when you could find a lot of great wines from the 70s and early 80s in people's cellars and get a really great glimpse of the golden years of Napa Valley wines.
So, folks, you know what to do. Check out everything going on with Somms and Sliders and taste your way through some special, hand-picked Napa Valley bottles. To learn more about how sommeliers are using Napa wines in restaurants, in particular with burgers, visit www.sommsandsliders.com. SOMMSANDSLIDERS.
Some really big news from 750. They've announced online ordering. Ordering on 750 is more than just simply adding items to a shopping cart. It's actually a complete order management system that streamlines the process of creating, sending, and tracking all of your orders to all of your multiple distributors. The best part of all of this is that it's designed to fit into your existing email ordering process, the one you already have. And you get to still work with the same distributor sales reps that you always do. But now there's less confusion for everyone, because what you have intended to order becomes automatically generated with detailed product information inside of the message. Also, order history with each distributor is stored on 750. That way you can easily reorder previously purchased products with just a simple click. This is the greatest. It's exactly what everyone has always wanted in this profession. And if you're excited to be working simpler and with less confusion, 750 has you covered with a great new ordering platform. If you have not already signed up for 750, you should check it out. 750.com has more information about a better way to do business with less headaches and more effectiveness. Check it out. 750.com is going to save you time and make you more effective at what you already like to do.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Isabel Legeron of Natural Wine, the book, and also the Raw Wine Fair in London, New York, and also Berlin. Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good. I'm really like super happy to be here and chatting with you today.
Great to have you here.
Thank you.
So you're French. You grew up in...
I grew up... Oh my gosh, yes. I'm 100% French. I mean, I've been living in London for 20 years, but I was brought up on a farm. I was brought up... You know, my family have a vineyard. We had animals, pigs, you know, made jams. We had chickens and all of this. And I had to work in the vineyard when I was a kid, which is why I decided quite quickly that I didn't want to be working in a vineyard. And I ran off to university, ended up in London for a job. And then that was 20 years ago.
What was the family like?
I mean, it was, you know, very, very small. We did everything. It was all hand harvesting. Until my dad decided actually it was better to have a machine, and it was better to sort of go down the route of using pesticides and fungicides and so on.
So you saw it in your own home, like you saw that change happen.
Yeah, my grandparents, we're like six or seven generation sort of, you know, grape growers in the Cognac region, and everybody in my family is involved with farming. My great granddad, in fact, had a horse and cart and a small distilling machine. And he went from house to house and just, you know, was distilling. So we have one pot still at home. And my dad in the 60s, 70s, started to sort of change the way he was farming. He really bought into the dream that if he started to use chemicals, you know, weed killers in the vineyards, and he would not have to work so hard, could go on holidays, and then started the whole process of you know, conventional farming. Unfortunately.
So that kind of would have happened during your childhood.
Yeah, I saw it happen. I saw us moving from having teams of people, you know, harvesting the vineyards to having just one giant machine just doing the job in, you know, in like a week rather than us working for 4 weeks. I saw, you know, I spoke to my grandmother a little while ago because my grandparents gave vineyards to my mom and my dad. And when they married, then they brought the whole thing together. And my grandmother was telling me what it was like when she was growing up. You know, when they were looking for snails in the vineyards, there were loads of mushrooms in the vineyards. I remember going and looking for wild asparagus in the vineyard, you know, when I was little. And progressively, as I was growing up, all of these things sort of began, you know, disappearing for sure. And now I go, my brother is a farmer and took over, and he's farming conventionally. And I actually hate going into the vineyards in the back of the house.
Yeah. So how are the holidays? Not so good? You're like, can you pass me? No, actually, I don't even.
Oh my gosh! Yes, so we do not talk about this anymore. I go there four or five times a year, and I was like, you know, I used to be a lot more militant and, you know, trying to change him, and now I just think that's his choice. You know,
right.
I think when you farm organically, you really it has to come from the heart, because otherwise you'll never go through with it.
Do you ever mess with them, or are you ever like, so how's the wild asparagus this year?
Gosh. No, we really don't. And I don't, yeah, I don't even want to go into the vents. I think maybe my nephews, because he one of them is going to take over, and I've, you know, I put him on a job experience with Olivier Cousin, because I thought, you know, hopefully that will, you know, get him thinking. And he came back, and actually he's starting asking questions. He's only 20. So, you know, I think I've got hopes that maybe he will be the one reverting back to how it was.
Oh, maybe well played on your part there. Subtle move on the chessboard.
Yeah, manipulation.
Because your whole, I mean, I guess we should just tell everybody, most of your academic career in the writing and the TV and the fairs has really been in the other direction, emphasizing the old ways, natural wine, less intervention. So did you immediately feel like, you know, a paradise was lost, or, you know, what was the progression there? Was that something that was clear to you as a kid that you used to like it more before, or did it have emotional ties that resonated within your own family for your experience, or how did it work out?
It was a progression. And I think it was, you know, just me getting more mature and more in tune with my instincts. But, you know, when I was a kid, I loved how I was being brought up, but I really wanted to see other stuff. So I went to university, I studied business, got a job in London. I was running, you know, like publishing titles and things like this in the end. But, you know, my background, I was really missing the farm, and I was really missing home. And I thought, actually, you know, maybe it's time for me to give in a little bit and actually study about wine. So in 2000, I sort of stopped what I was doing, and I went and I studied the WSET. But when I, even though I was brought up on a grape farm, you know, when I started my studies, I didn't know like a Chablis was a Chardonnay, right? I was starting from like zero, you know, I had zero knowledge, zero culture in terms of the actual wines because I was, you know, my family makes cognac. So it was a slow, you know, long sort of learning curve. But as I progressed through my studies with the WSET, the Master of Wine afterwards, which I did, I realized that, you know, the world of wine is actually a very hardcore business-driven world. It's not about farming. It's not about being in the vineyard or collecting wild herbs and stuff like this. So I became very slowly sort of disappointed with the industry. And, you know, I didn't really, for me, like scoring wines and this kind of like intellectualization of wine. I just like, you know, it didn't work for me. You know, I became more and more detached and I thought, actually, maybe I've made a big mistake by quitting my job and doing the wine stuff. But at the same time, I started, you know, one moment that happened for me was I was researching for a TV program in Hungary. And I was clear that if I was going to go and shoot something in Hungary, I was clear that I needed to find people working with indigenous grapes. So I refused to work with, to showcase Cabernet Franc and things like this. So I asked some people to put together a huge tasting for me in Budapest. And I tasted everything blind. It was about 250 wines. And then two wines, I pulled them out of the lot. And I said, I want to meet these people because what they're doing is amazing. And the guy said to me, well, it's the same person. It was a guy called Imre Kahlo in Eger. And I said, great, take me to him. I want to meet him. And then I meet this guy who, you know, is a forester. He has some vines, organic vines, and he has two hand-dug cellars. And he makes 145, 150 different wines in these two tiny rooms because every barrel is different. Every barrel is an experiment. You know, he does a lot of skin contact, but he wasn't even aware that people were really making orange wines. He makes a lot of sweet red wines just because they're not fermenting. He, like everything that, you know, every permutation of that grape variety, he tries it because he loves doing that. He doesn't own a press. He only has very old barrels. And then that's it. You know, it's very simple. And at that moment, when I met him, I just thought that, you know, you don't need multi-million pound facilities to make great wines. You don't need fancy equipments, fancy wineries with big tasting rooms with views over whatever. All you need is commitment, passion, you know, great vines, and then, you know, just doing some stuff in the cellar. And that was the beginning of sort of me realizing that, you know, there is actually a world out there of people who resonate and who just do, you know, think like I do. And that was sort of, for me, the beginning of then a discovery.
So what was the UK scene like at that time, 2000?
You know, big primeur campaigns, you know, the primeur was still, you know, super strong. You know, it was, I mean, for me anyway, my reality was, you know, I had to taste all the Dom Pérignon Cru and Cristal, all the Petrus, Ikem. You know, I was on that, like, you know.
You were on that track.
I was on that track. I was just like completely determined. So I'm really happy I did all of that because I think it's really important. You know, you have to, I really believe that if you want to maybe have an impact on the establishment, I really believe it's, for me, it's better to be inside because then you can actually say something. So for me, it was really important to do all of this. And obviously the scene has changed, you know, it's like over here, you know, over the past 20 years, things have changed a lot. For me, it was just a really gradual process to now, really.
But how many people were there around to talk about those kind of thoughts with? Like, hey, I saw this cool guy in Hungary. How many people do you have that conversation with?
No one, but I wasn't actually, for me, you know, when I went into the wine industry, I didn't really have any peers. Like I knew nobody in the wine industry. You know, it was just suddenly thought, my family grow grapes. Actually, I quite like wine and I quite like the farming. I'm in London. I might as well study in London because, you know, I had my family and things. So I was not in an industry. So, you know, and I was doing television. You know, I happened to sort of do actually quite a lot of television because I was good at presenting and I loved food. So I didn't really have, you know, I don't.
For me, kind of looking at the career, it kind of seems like you're okay with being an outsider. I don't know if it's something you seek out, but it's something that certainly when it happens, you're fine with it.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've always, you know, it's not a choice, but my love for the farms and the types of wine that I work with in any way always put me, you know, I was always an outsider, you know, I was the one writing essays that would be defending natural fermentation and the non-use of sulfites. All throughout my life, you know, at home, I was always the one reading the books and wanting to go to the theater, but my it's not really something my family did. I was just, I've always sort of, whenever I want something or I believe in something, I just go for it. But I don't really ask, I jump and I hope the parachute sort of opens. That's kind of how I've always behaved, And when I became an MW, I was like, okay, at this point, I have two options. Either I can just go and actually follow a pretty, probably sort of quite a lucrative career and being a master of wine and having, job pretty much whatever I wanted to do. Or I just say, well, let's just go through with this and see what happens and create a reality, create an event around what I believed, try and get a book published, sort of carve a niche out of, in a way that didn't exist, it's...
So did you see anything like that in the publishing world from before where you're like, it's kind of important to grab hold of a niche? Like, had you had some idea that, having a niche is a good thing to do, or did it just kind of happen?
No, it was just, it's like in anything, I really believe you can do anything you want, I think if you put if you follow your heart and you put the work and you put the hours, anything is achievable. I mean, I think, if you decided suddenly, actually, I don't want to be doing this radio stuff anymore. I want to become the world expert in absinthe, and you go and spend 2 years developing your own, absinthe. I'm sure you'd be probably a world leader in absinthe. I think anything is possible. And I think the key for me and why I've never, it's been really hard work, but I've always followed my instinct. I've always followed what I felt was the right thing for me.
It also feels to me like you caught it at a moment where it was comprehensible. Like, there weren't so many thousands of people that you had to talk to in the natural wine world when you got in. Like, if you'd said, I'm going to be the world's foremost expert in Chardonnay, that would have been a lot of air miles. That would have been a lot of travel. That would have been a lot of talking to a lot of people in a lot of different climates. But, you're like, hey, it's 2000, 2002, 2003. Mm. I'm interested in natural wine. I mean, how many people is that? Mm. That's a few hundred people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, absolutely. I was, and particularly with my training and being an MW, championing sort of, natural wine, low intervention, organic, biodynamic, wines. It also gave me, in a way, sort of, I guess people listened to what I had to say because I came from a classical background.
Right.
And that really helped as well, for sure.
But I understand that you came from a classical background in terms of the imprimatur of the MW, which obviously clearly helps when you're trying to get articles published, or especially in London, I feel like. But where I don't think you came from a classical background is to actually grow up on a farm, because I don't see so many MWs who did. Now, obviously, there's like Zinthumbrech and others, but it's not so common. And what I think about natural wine is that it seems to have come from the growers as opposed to the previous kind of thing, which I would have said came from critics or marketers and or business people. And so, because a lot of times here, I see people who want to ascribe natural wine to an importer or to a critic, but I don't think that those came first. I think that people who didn't want to get cancer by working in the vineyards in a natural way came first, and then everything else followed. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, I think of course you're not wrong. The grower is really, where the inspiration comes from, and I think it's also where the strengths come from in terms of, how much I've learned, how much I've developed. I have learned more from spending time with the growers and having dinner with them and spending the whole day and talking about their vines and their plants than I've done in reading, all these books about viticulture of winemaking. So I don't know if that really answers your question.
Well, I feel like there was this whole culture that was like, we don't really care if the establishment cares about us. Mm. We're going to do our thing. They'd seen so much pushback from the conventional side. They're like, cool, people don't want to write about us. Mm. We're still going to be friends. We're still going to drink the wines we want. We're still going to make the wines we want. They developed such a strong community, and then that became appealing, and then it grew and grew and grew. And then you show up at some point and you're like, hey, I'm in the establishment, and also I'm super interested. They're probably like, wow, first one. Or, there are probably not so many. So, I mean, what was that really like? I'm just
guessing, right? But what was that like? Because what I see now, even to this day, is a natural wine community that's kind of like, yeah, maybe we'll let you in. Like, maybe you're legit, maybe you're not, you know? So what was it like when you reached out to some of the people in the grower world, and how did they receive you?
It always, it's always been, you know, really easy and great. And I think, you know, I think the growers who work with nature have really strong intuition. And I think they, I don't know, I think they are really, I think they can feel whether you are, you know, trying to sort of, I don't know, just ride the kind of the fashion wave, or whether, you know, you're one of them, you know, whether you actually really care about nature. Because to be honest, fundamentally, for me, the beauty of these growers is the love and the really deep respect for nature. And natural wine is just an expression, is just a transformation of this agriculture. You know, I think fundamentally, these men and women are, they are really in tune with nature. I think they're in tune with people, and I think it's quite easy, actually, if you're genuine. I think it's quite easy to be part of this community, because it's a really loving community, and it's quite a big community. You know, there are people everywhere, but everybody's always been super, super welcoming, super generous with their time, their hospitality. You know, even if they may maybe, you know, you just go in and crash on the sofa because there's already 20 people staying there, or but I think it's quite easy to go into that community. They really, really are very welcoming.
So did you find it harder on the other side of your life, like on the more the wine trade side? Was that more of an uphill climb?
It wasn't a fit. You know, I'm not very good at, like, you know, being into a dinner where everything is sort of, you know, you have to dress up to attend a dinner where, you know, then you have to have like very serious pairing where there's like really long talks over what the vintage conditions were that year. I don't really have a lot of time for that. You know, I like to have, you know, really honest conversation, maybe something that's cooking on the stove, just a soup, you know, a piece of bread, like really, you know, the wines that they make, and just talking about, you know, what they're doing and how they're using, you know, these plants, and, you know, to help, you know, heal the vines or build the immunity system of the plant, which is, you know, a lot of people are working with, for example. So for me, it's just, I never was really sort of super comfortable. I've got a lot of friends in the conventional wine world, of course, you know, all my peers, you know, that I studied with, or, you know, a lot of buyers, or, of course, and I have a lot of respect, and I, you know, like, there's really no issue, and I really like them. It's just for me, you know, it just doesn't really feel very comfortable. I'm not at home. Whereas when I go into, you know, and spend some time with some of the growers, I'm just really at home, you know, very simply.
I mean, I've met a lot of people in the wine world who are specifically trying to engage with the luxury side because that's not where they're from. They want to have that part in their life because that's what they got into the wine trade for, to engage with the luxury side. I'm sure you've met people like this.
Yeah. You know. And I think, you know, wine has become a status symbol. You know, like, knowing about wine in a way means that you're successful. It means that you've you know a little bit about wine. You know, you can afford, obviously, you know, good wine. I don't know. I think we've become so intellectual about wine. We think too much about wine in a way. You know, wine is, of course, you know, and look at, you know, look at like your piles of books. And of course, there's so much going on, you know, in terms of terroir and all of this. But I think at the same time, it's really important to remember that wine is a food, you know, wine is an agricultural product. Wine is actually really simple. It doesn't have to have this huge, you know, position on a pedestal, you know, with a whole industry feeding off that, a whole industry discussing the vintage variations. And I'm not saying there's not a room for that, but I think what we've done in the wine industry by elevating wine to such a position is we've alienated a lot of people who feel intimidated by it, who don't feel they can taste a wine and trust the instinct that will tell them that the wine is actually pretty good. Because they'll be worried that maybe this critic said, you know, this wine is not good, or that they're not going to enjoy it. You know, for me, the greatest pleasures I've had is with people doing a tasting, showing people wine. They know nothing about it. I don't even really tell them that much. But seeing that they are actually really enjoy it, or they can take, you know, they can pick out quality. If you listen to your instinct, your body knows if it's a good wine, if the wine is really good quality. I really think that.
There does seem to be a digestible quality to some of my favorite natural wines. Like, I find them easy to drink.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's one of the, I think, for me, you know, when I taste a wine, is this something that I would actually really want to drink? Or is this just something I'm intellectually enjoying tasting because it's, you know, showing me maybe various, you know, variations in the terroir or something like this? But I think fundamentally the beauty of natural wine is the fact that it is highly digestible. It's very Moorish.
So who were some of the key people that you met that had kind of founded the scene or were pillars of the scene and the natural community when you started to enter into it yourself?
Well, for me, one of the most inspiring characters is spending time with, you know, Pierre Auvernois, because he, you know, he's obviously been doing it for a long time. When you spend time with him, you learn a lot about his the fermentation process. He's very good at explaining, you know, details about the yeast population that he would be observing and deciding when the vintage would be going on. He's always, you know, so generous that we, you know, I've been very lucky to taste like really old stuff with him. And in a, you know, he's like a gentle giant of the natural wine world and really inspiring and, you know, a whole Bible and a whole history. So for me, he's a, you know, he's a very precious person. I also enjoy spending some time with Jacques Néoport because he has influenced a lot of people around the Loire, the Beaujolais, the Rhone. You know, he's really the one who I think articulated sort of Jules Chauvet's, you know, natural winemaking and help a lot of growers make natural wine. So he's also a wealth of stories, of anecdotes, of knowledge that actually he's not very good at sharing because he's an incredibly shy character and doesn't, you know, he doesn't really like the limelight. You know, you don't really know he was around so much in, you know, in crafting really amazing wines, even, you know, with Chave and obviously Lapierre and Breton and so on. So there's a raft of people who, you know, Didier Barral, when you spend some time with him and you really begin to understand the importance of non-farming, the importance of the model of the forest when you don't do any intervention, the perfection of the forest in absorbing all the water or dealing with drought. So, you know, his approach to farming is really amazing. And I think, you know, when you meet people who just pursue their own journey in their own vineyard, in their own terroir, who are not afraid of experimenting, who are like beautiful observers of their piece of land, you know, they really go through the whole process. And that's, for me, that's the beautiful art form, the proper craft of what these people are doing. And there's so much to learn, you know, I think, from these people.
So you've mentioned the word experiment a couple of times. And for me, here in New York, that's often a term that comes up from people who are critical of natural wine, because they say, oh, I want a good wine, not an experiment. They want something that's like established, you know. But do you feel it's still experimental, or do you feel like people... or some people have figured it out, or is there something that, you know, has shown to work, or is it still kind of like, I don't know, let's see.
There's no rule book, you know, no one's written the guide to making natural wine, right? I think the minute you expect something which is not an experiment, then you go into a recipe that is relying on a lot of gadgetry or additives, so that you always have this very reliable outcome, which is probably something that you would use in a lot of the food industry, for example. If you start working with nature, I think, A, you realize that it's never the same, that, you know, you have proper vintage variation, that the vintage is going to throw elements that you've never seen before, and you don't have the tools, like, you know, whether it's sort of adding a lot of bunch of sulfites on at crushing because there's, you know, bacteria you want to get rid of, or, you know, so you don't necessarily have that toolbox that a lot of people are using and, you know, that people are teaching about it at university. You're on your own and inevitably you're experimenting. I think if you speak to all the growers out there, even people who have been making a lot of vintages and maybe you think they're not experimenting, I think for me experimenting is part of the journey. You know, I don't think it means, for me, that's not a negative. I think if you stop experimenting, I think you're probably dead, you know, and then you might as well just rely on all your gadgetry, because it's a, the outcome is a given. When you work with nature, you know that you're not in control. You just have to really trust that the work you've done in the vineyard, in the end, will work out, because nature also is beautiful, you know, and it doesn't always work out. But I think, of course, you're always experimenting.
So it's interesting for me here in that answer, and then also reading your book, how much the idea of kind of a quest is alluded to, if not necessarily articulated. And I mean, do you see it as kind of like a heroic quest? The people are referred to in kind of heroic terms when I read things you've written.
You mean me saying that they are like heroes?
Yeah.
All these, because I really think they are. You know, I think, look, who in this day and age, right? Most people will lead a pretty safe life. Okay. Here you have people who basically walk on the tightrope without a safety net, and at any point they could lose everything that they're doing. Okay, so already you're like in this scenario where every step that you make is full of risk, where you could actually lose your vintage. They put everything. You know, of course there are growers who probably do it because, you know, it sounds good, it sells, you know, they use the word natural or whatever. But really fundamentally, if you are going to be walking that walk, you have got to do it 100%. And you throw everything that you have. You do, you know, you're there, you get to know your vineyard, you get to know your vines, because you know that your vines are everything. Absolutely. They are reinventing everything. You know, they are the guys who are, and women, but, you know, collectively who are understanding the role of some wild herbs, you know, how that can help the health of the vineyard. You know, they are real innovators. For me, they are heroes.
So do you see it in a way that this knowledge existed before and then was lost in sort of a dark age and now has come back by people like you're talking about? Or do you see it as like these are new discoveries that are, you know, brand new, or how does it work? I mean, did someone know at one time that the herbs were going to do this, and then we sort of lost that in a culture, and now it's coming back? Or are we at the cutting edge, or are we at a what I would think of as a traditional revival?
I think probably a lot of it is knowledge that we used to have. I'm sure that, you know, if you look at biodynamics, you know, biodynamics is really, when you take into account very simply, you know, at a very basic level, when you take into account the lunar cycle, you know, this is a force that we've been working with for millennia. What I mean is, you know, it's not Rudolf Steiner in 1924 or 25 who said, you know, we need to use the power of the moon. So a lot of the wisdom which is being used, and maybe it was not necessarily used in vineyards, or maybe there were herbs that were used for healing something else. But I think a lot of the knowledge, you know, was there. But, you know, I'm sure a long time ago. I mean, I don't have any, you know, this is just for me being, you know, quite, you know, I think this is more of a sensical, commonsensical answer. I think a lot of what we're using, and whether it's herbal remedies or was used and has been used for a long time. But I think what happened, you know, with the First World War, the Second World War, you know, and the advent of using so much stuff in the vineyards and pesticides and things, I think it's something that got lost. You know, when I speak to my grandmother and I ask her about, you know, herbs like yarrow or which I use at home, you know, it's something that she would have used, but then my parents didn't use it that much. So I think that throughout the ages, I'm sure that a lot of that knowledge that people are using now was used, you know, maybe a millennia ago. I'm pretty sure of it. So if you speak to, for example, Daniele Piccini in the Veneto, he distills and collects wild plants around his vineyards, distills them, and then uses it to spray and help combat, you know, disease. Right, more or less successfully. You know, he's had successes. Sometimes it doesn't work so much. You know, he's also using a process called spaggiare, which is basically, he's got a pizza oven and he will burn down the plants to their white ash. This is alchemy, you know, and it's a process that was used a long time ago. And he's reviving this, you know, because he believes that really makes a big impact. So he's basically burning all the plants down to their white ashes. And then he's using that in, you know, alongside distilling other plants and spraying that on the vineyards. So these are very old traditions, But I think what we're seeing now is, and I think it's true of any industry, I think it's true of any farming or bread making or cheese making, is I think now we're really embracing a lot of the very traditional methods. And I think we're applying maybe some, you know, sometimes some science, or you have really dedicated young people who are trying that out. And in a way, I think they're understanding better. They are, you know, using it for, you know, maybe in a more specific way. But I think what we're doing is we're rediscovering a lot of these very ancient traditions, for sure, rather than, you know, things being suddenly it's something which is brand new or something.
So I like to wander around art museums, and I often go to the medieval area because there's not a lot of people there. It's not like going to Impressionism where you have to fight through. And so there's these Book of Hours, and they were prayer books, but they were also agricultural books. They were like manuals that people looked at and kept with them. And the relationship between when you're supposed to do some farming activity in terms of like plowing and then when you're supposed to pray is very articulated in these books with pictures. And so for me, when I'm not a farmer, and also I haven't read Steiner in the original, but for me, when I think of what biodynamics is, it seems like a reemergence of this tendency, but without the God picture. So do you see a religious overtone or a religious undertone to some of these procedures that's kind of latent in old Europe?
Not particularly, but that's maybe because I'm not sort of super versed in you know, I don't really think religiously. I don't really, you know, for me, my main sort of religion, I would say, if anything, is nature. And I really believe in the greater power of nature and the greater order of nature. And I think if anything, I would say that biodynamics or that these practices are actually very pagan, and it's more of a respect of the cycle of nature. You know, one thing which is interesting, I think, with horse plowing, which we could say is a pretty traditional, you know, way of farming with animals. When you plow with your horse, you have to follow the rhythm of nature. You cannot plow if it's too hot because your horse cannot do it, which means actually you're not really disturbing the earth when it's too hot, and you're not evaporating all this precious humidity in you know, in the soil, for example. You know, so I think the rhythm, and I think being, you know, a lot more in touch with, you know, greater forces, you know, planets and stars and so on. And, you know, for me, is more, which, you know, maybe sort of biodynamic followers are going to say, you know, what are you saying? For me, is more in touch with pagan sort of beliefs and a deep respect for like natural cycles. And I think what we're seeing now in farming, you know, is a return to this. It's something that we had before, where polyculture was the norm, where you had your in a way a holistic farm. You know, where you had your animals, you grew your wheat, you had your chickens running around fertilizing. You had everything was in equilibrium in a way, because, you know, monoculture doesn't exist in nature. We created that. So I think if anything, what we're seeing now, where people are reintroducing animal husbandry, for example, is very simply a return to, you know, the old farming tradition that was maybe more based on self-subsistence. But people are realizing that it makes sense. I know everything plays a role. Everything connects. You know, the role of the animals, the roles of the insects, of the different flowers, and all of this basically contributes for me to the much bigger picture.
So what's the payoff for the drinker? I mean, why choose that bottle as opposed to another? I get the idea of, you know, being on a quest. That alone could be stimulating and fulfilling. I get the idea of reconnecting with the lost past. That alone could be stimulating, fulfilling. I get the idea of not wanting to get cancer, not wanting to use pesticides, not wanting to use herbicides. But in terms of the person who's picking at the retail level, who's saying this one or that one, what's the payoff for them?
First of all, if we look at just the farming, you know, if you're not getting killed because you're actually farming it, you know, you know, when you farm conventionally, you actually have pesticide residues in your bottle. So that's number one. You know, that's for me, it's a choice of what I'm putting in my body. You know, it's exactly the same thing when I go to the supermarket and I pick this product over this one because, you know, it's not GM and it's organic. And so that's my first commitment. And I think with wine, obviously there's that same, it's the same mentality. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people believe that, you know, if it's wine, it's just pressed out of the ground, put in a bottle and nothing else has happened. So I think first off, there is the clear element of the pesticide residues. So that's, you know, that's a very simple farming question, right? And what you put in your body. And then there's the winemaking angle. I really believe for me that wine has to be a representation of that piece of land at that moment in time, so that particular vintage. And I think if you, and I believe that if you drink wines made naturally, where you haven't had, you know, haven't used all types of gadgetry to maybe zap out excess water, zap out excess sugar, where you can really rectify in a way the vintage variation, you know, that you are getting a frank representation of that wine in that year. Similarly, I think that if you let the wine ferment naturally, then yeast is part of terroir, you know, and I think the multitude of the yeast population. If you look under a microscope and you have juice just, you know, coming from an organic vineyard and picked at the right moment when the population is at the right stage of diversity, then suddenly you have a wine which will have greater complexity and be a greater sort of showcase of that terroir, because yeasts are part of terroir. So I think every time for me that you add something or you remove something, I think that you take away from that idea that we all talk about, which is that this idea of terroir.
Because sometimes what I hear in terms of criticism of natural wine is that the faults get in the way of expressing the terroir of the place. So how would you respond to that? Like the idea that, yeah, it's too volatile, or it's too bready, or it's too something else, or it's too airplane glue, and for that reason, I can't get the terroir. So what do you think?
I think that's an exaggeration. If I look at all the wines I've tasted recently, yeah, maybe sometimes there's a little bit of bread, but to be honest, there's a little bread in a lot of what people will call, you know, Bordeaux terroir or Rhone terroir. You know, they very often there's an expression of bread in there. Volatility is the same. I think these faults are actually not that present to me in natural wine. You do find wines that are, you know, slightly faulty. You do find conventional wines that are slightly faulty. I don't think you can generalize and talk about natural wine and say that, you know, a lot of them are faulty and a lot of them are not an expression of terroir.
You would agree that people do that, though, right?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I've seen people. I'm not saying I do, but I've seen people do that quite often.
Yeah, yeah, sure, but it's not because they you know, they do that it's a reality. I think what I find is you know, when I hear criticism of people saying, "Oh, I had that wine. Oh my god, it was too volatile, or it was too funky," or I sort of I accept that, but what wine was it? And you know, 9 times out of 10 the other person is actually incapable of giving me the name of the grower or the name of that cuvée.
I've experienced that as well. Like, they don't want to name the name.
Yeah,
and you're like, what does that mean? They're like, well, I don't want to offend somebody. And you're like, well, yeah, but you're offending a whole category. You have to, I mean, if you want to submit evidence, I'm happy to review it.
Well, yeah,
but you have to tell me the name.
Exactly. And also, I think then we can be on the same wavelength. You know, then if they say to me, it's because it's this producer, and I say, okay, well, maybe you have a point, and maybe in that vintage something happened or whatever. Or then I can say, well, I completely disagree with that. And then we're just looking at different ways of assessing what a fault is. You know, that's something. The other thing I think is, like, people who often say that, I find that actually they haven't really tasted natural wine. They haven't really gone to the trouble of meeting the people. So their tasting experience is uber limited. Maybe they've had a few and maybe they thought, actually, it's not worth it. That's fine. But I find that very often people who say that is just shows a lack of tasting experience for me.
Do you think the line on what is a fault is changing or is in discussion of, you know, whether that's a plus or a minus?
You have good questions.
I mean, for instance, I like Volatile City when it's Chateau Musard. I happen to enjoy that.
Yeah.
I like the wine. And they say, yeah, it's a little volatile. We do it that way. You know, and I like 90 Monroe's. It's got a lot of Brett. I like the wine. So.
Yeah, sure. But does that mean that it's changing? I mean, I think the perception of what a fault is really differs from you know, one person to another. And for me, you know, in a way, you know, I love this quote by the guys at Clos Perdu who said, you know, perfection is flirting with faults. And I think that's, for me, that what, in a way, natural wine is, because it's that's what nature is. You know, you don't, you know, it's like when you meet somebody, you want people to have spikes and be interesting and exciting. And maybe sometimes you're not going to like it because it's going to rub you, you know, the wrong way. But it doesn't mean that you should dismiss it as a terrible person. And I think wines is a bit like this. And you know, which is why I really, when I hear this criticism, I need to know what people are talking about, because I think very often there's just a discrepancy, or there's just a different reality. If somebody, of course, expects, you know, this kind of like squeaky clean, the same year, the same wine, you know, year in, year out, and but sometimes it is something that maybe has a little bit of volatility, or maybe they'll be completely surprised and hate that. And I think that's also part of our challenge, is that I find very often that people are tasting with blinkers, you know, and we taste, and people taste with their eyes. So when you give them a certain type of wine, particularly, you know, for example, a Sauvignon Blanc, people will have an idea as to what the Sauvignon Blanc should taste like, because in our head, we've got these Sauvignon Blancs that have been fashioned for 30, 40 years, you know, made pretty much with the same yeast all around the world. So suddenly, you know, this is what a Sauvignon Blanc tastes like. And then you give them something, you know, made by Alexandre Aubin or Sébastien Riffaut, who goes through full ripeness, full mallow, no sulfites, no fining, no filtering, and they're exposed to something completely different. And I think, you know, the beauty of wine is the diversity, and we have to embrace this diversity, basically, and get rid of, you know, it's in a way, it's almost like rediscovering wine, you know, because the face of modern wine now is only, you know, the first yeast came about in the 1970s, really properly commercially. So, you know, this new face of wine is 40-year-old, right?
So what about ageability? Sometimes I hear people say, natural wines, you got to drink them young. They don't age very well. I mean, what's your experience with that?
I think again, it's like lack of tasting experience, and I don't blame people who say that, because you know we are in a society where, you know, even with natural wine, we just drink them and we drink them, and no one really actually buys wines, collects them, ages them, and then like takes them out, you know, in 10 years. We're not really in that stage, but if you go and visit growers, if you get people to sort of take out older examples of wines made completely naturally, you will see that actually there's a tremendous aging potential in those wines. I mean, I have had countless experiences of wines. I mean, I sell a little bit of wine myself, you know, whether it's, you know, tasting with Pierre Auvernois stuff back from the 1950s, or also, you know, other producers where, you know, who work naturally and they get out like a 10-year-old, 20-year-old, 30-year-old wine, which is completely alive, which is, you know, vibrant. You know, for me, there's no doubt that you can age wine without any sulfites.
Leaving aside Auvernois, which is hard for some of us to get sometimes now, what would be other examples of wines that are made in a natural idiom that have aged well?
Well, if you look at DRC, I think is a very good example. You know, they have made wines without any sulfites. I happened to sort of share a bottle of 1969 with a friend who had it lying around in his cellar, you know, just a Vendôme Romané. And then I spoke to the guy who made it, and he said, oh, I did about 20 parts or 25 parts, you know, at bottling. You know, and that's a 1969 wine, and it was singing. And it was, when we poured it, it was quite shy, and then it was just like an explosion of fruits. There was still some, so almost not primary, but it was, you know, still quite overt, like utterly delicious. And the wine just like, you know, we decanted it and we drank it throughout the day. And it was just like a really, really beautiful, beautiful wine. The thing is, not all wines are made to be matured. either. You know, you have wines that are made for early consumption. You also have terroirs that lend themselves better to maturity. I'm sure it's easier to make wine if you're like on Etna and you've got this amazing terroir and this amazing minerality that's also really helping with, you know, pH and complexity. It's probably, you know, easier to make long-lived wines than rather than if you're like somewhere on the flats with extremely rich soil. Or you can also make decisions when in your winemaking process. But I think not all wines are meant to be aged, but not all conventional wines are made to be aged.
So if you could have early drinkers and ageable wines, wines that are reflective of terroir and wines that are more complex from the natural idiom, why are so many producers resisting going in that way? It seems like it offers everything that someone could want. Why wouldn't they do it? Because it seems that many are not.
Not everybody is that way inclined. You know, I think you have to really have it in you. You know, some people prefer to be on the safe side. You know, if you've developed also like a marketplace, an expectation of the market of that your wines are going to be like this and you sell well, you know, some people might not really want to take the risk. And, you know, I think you really, it's a decision that needs to come from the heart. You know, I've seen so many people. In fact, I was doing a talk in Austria 2 years ago, and they invited me to talk because it was a big marketing conference, and they wanted me to sort of talk about my experience with raw wine and natural wine and why they should be going in that direction, because it's obviously the future. You know, that was the kind of like my remit. And I said to them, I said, you know, if you go into this direction because it makes marketing sense, you know, none of you is ever going to be successful, because it's a challenge. Every day you have to, you know, it's every day you have to go through obstacles, challenges, nature, the market, you know. So clearly it really takes a very specific type of person to go down that route. I don't think everybody can do it.
Is it harder to scale? Is it harder to make more production?
I think so. Look, I think in my experience, I think, you know, people who make tops 50 to 60,000 bottles is a bit of a stretch. You know, I find that a lot of growers farm between about 5 and maybe 12, 15 hectares maybe, but then you need to have, you know, a bit more manpower. But it's basically whatever is manageable humanly, you know, with one or two people, you know, so you can keep the contact, so you know your vines, so you can walk your vineyards, so you know the juice that comes in, so you can keep an eye on the juice and be there. You know, the minute you start, you know, having a bigger team, and then I think you just lose the touch, really.
So I get the situation about not wanting to use herbicides, not wanting to use pesticides, being very careful about inputs. But why is sulfur such an issue? I understand that less additives are typically good, but what is so harmful about sulfur? Because it does seem to be a kind of a sibboleth of whether you're a natural wine producer or not, it seems like. But I don't quite get why that particular thing is so important.
Obviously, it's just one of the elements. I guess, you know, from a practical perspective, you know, sulfur is quite easy to measure. People have focused on it a lot because it says contain sulfites, you know, on the bottle. So I think it's an additive that people are very familiar with. And in a way, it's a question that comes up quite easily from a wine drinker out there. They pick up the bottle, contain sulfites. Ooh, what does that mean? So I think there's a lot of confusion, and maybe it's worth explaining that when it says contain sulfites, actually it doesn't mean anything, because contain sulfites can be anywhere between, you know, from 10 parts per million all the way to 150 to 200 parts per million to 400 parts per million per liter, right? Which is actually a lot. Contain sulfites is, for me, is just a ridiculous mention on a label. You need to have a number attached to it. I actually personally react to sulfites, right? So at home or anywhere, I don't buy wines that have more than 20 to 30 parts, because I don't enjoy them. I don't like drinking them. I get palpitations from them. You know, I'll have a dull headache. The next morning, I'll know definitely that I've had, I've drunk wines that had maybe a bit more sulfites than I wanted to. And even if I do a tasting, a couple of years ago, I did a tasting because, you know, somebody really twisted my arm to taste a whole bunch of stuff with quite high levels of sulfites. And I actually had mouth ulcers from tasting it, simply because I'm not used to putting that in my body. So I've developed a bit of a, I would say, intolerance to sulfites. And in fact, you know, when you, from a medical perspective, and again, I'm not making any claims, there's research that's been, you know, obviously that's ongoing and it's very easy to read about it. But some research seems to suggest that when you put the combination of wine, of alcohol and sulfites together in your body, it inhibits your body's ability to actually digest the alcohol. So this combination, from a health perspective, makes it harder, which means you're actually the alcohol is in your body for, you know, for longer. Just to put it really simply, and they've done studies that show that actually when you drink wine without any sulfites, that you know, your body assimilates it better. So there is, you know, this also medical aspect, because I know people always say, yeah, but there's sulfites in apricots and there's sulfites on salads, but then you don't have that alcohol element as well, that, you know, that contributes to the impact of sulfites on your body. From a living perspective, you know, the beauty of natural wines is they're alive, right? They're alive in the vineyard. When you make the wine, they literally have, you know, bacteria, they literally have yeast, you know, there's a vibrant community in, you know, in your wine. There's a microbiology happening. And when you use sulfites, well, you kill bacteria, you knock out the yeast population. So you physically actually take away some of that aliveness, which is why for me, it really changes, you know, what your wine is going to turn out to be. You can change, you know, if you add loads of sulfites, you can literally stop the malolactic fermentation from happening. So for me, that's part of the developmental process of a wine. Like puberty is malolactic. I think if the wine is going to go through malolactic, you should let it go through malolactic fermentation. So I think sulfites is quite an important thing, because it actually changes quite a lot of the wine's tasting features.
In terms of the market, what is the advantage of selling natural wines? You've done some work at Elliott's and at Hibiscus doing natural wine focused programs. So what is easy or challenging about doing that kind of program?
For me, in my opinion, I think natural wines actually lend themselves really well to food pairing. I find them very often, people don't really focus on oak, so they tend to be sort of, you know, slightly lighter, less extracted, often less alcoholic. So they're actually quite versatile. I think they respect the food, particularly if you work, you know, with maybe purer kitchens, you know, where it's not really all about like heavy sauces and things like this, but maybe more, you know, slightly more creative, lighter, or maybe more Nordic. Then I find natural wine actually are quite easy to pair with food. It's always amazing to be able to share wines with people that maybe they're not familiar with, and also get them to really enjoy the wine. So I think I find it always a really exciting experience when somebody tries natural wines for the, you know, for the first time. So I think there's also the aspect of the discovery, if people don't really know what it is. But of course it comes with challenges. You know, sometimes you do get people who are completely not into it and they don't really, you know, want to taste it. And you know, I think you just need to be really adaptable as well and you know, not force it down, literally down people's throat, if that's not what they want to be drinking. You know, natural wine has there's a community out there, right? It's almost a bit of it's not a huge community, but there's this underworld of people who are really into, you know, the origin of what they eat. They want to drink wine that they know is made organically and naturally, and there's a big following. You know, people will go to these places, and definitely there's a market for it.
So what draws those people? Is it some of the things we've been talking about today? Do people come in and say, I'm looking for a wine with native yeast and no sulfur? Or is it less technical than that? Is it wanting to be part of this community? Or is it wanting to do something closer to the earth? Or why is it that people decide to seek this out?
So if I look at the profile of the people who come to the fair, right, who are the people who actually come to all these restaurants, I'd say that the vast majority are sort of quite young, like in, you know, in 30s, 40s. They are the type of people who will really enjoy maybe sort of, you know, independent artists, independent music. But they're not necessarily wine drinkers, actually. That's the beauty of it. They're not wine geeks. They're not necessarily know a lot about you know, classic regions, or they haven't had a lot of experience tasting wines, and they are coming to wine, I think, and to wine through natural wine, because they find that the wines are actually quite approachable, because the environment is always really relaxed. And I think all of this actually maybe also, you know, helps.
Have you seen wines that are stylish or hip at this time talked about as natural when you know that perhaps they aren't?
Yeah, of course. Particularly when it comes to the farming. And also, I mean, let's go back to our friend, you know, sulfites, for example. I've got people who say, oh, we don't add any sulfites. Can we come to your fair? Or we're very low. And I get the analysis and actually I realize that they are, you know, in the 90s or the 100s, and they are actually red wines. And I'm thinking, and these would be growers that would be perceived as natural wines, which is why I think it's really important to have clarity and transparency, because nothing is written on the label. So actually it's okay to just say anything, you know. It's like saying with the farming that you're natural, but actually you don't even farm naturally. So it is a bit messy. You know, it is a bit messy. It is a bit confusing.
So for you, what's a good natural wine?
Well, first of all, it's a wine which is released on the market when it's ready. Okay. I think there is a lot of, you know, pressure in terms of cash flow for a lot of these growers. And there's pressure for them to sometimes release the wines before they're ready, because they need more space in the cellar, because they need money, because the market, you know, is running out of wine. There's obviously a commercial pressure there, which means that sometimes wines will be released within 6 months or 8 months, and they haven't gone through the proper maturing process. So for me, I like a wine when I drink it, I'm not a big fan of mousiness, for example. I've got very little time for this. So, you know, if the wine is mousy, you know, when I work in a restaurant and I buy a wine which is mousy, I either put an allocation on that wine and I wait maybe for a year, or, you know, I don't work with it, because then I know that suddenly the wine is, you know, other people will serve it, and then that's fine. If I personally buy a wine which is mousy, it doesn't really bother me, because I think the reduction in the bottle over time will disappear. But I think that we, you know, particularly if you work in the industry, I think it's our duty to put a wine in front of you which is, you know, in which is ready. So that's, you know, I guess number one in terms of what I would classify as a really good natural wine is people who can and who will as much as possible wait until, you know, until the wine is ready. But I understand it's not always possible.
So what is your experience of the Raw Fair? You've done it for several years in London. You did it in Berlin. Now you're going to do it in New York. What's it been like trying to organize what I imagine are a lot of big personalities?
Yeah. To be honest, the biggest challenge of organizing the event is not necessarily to bring it overseas and deal with a, you know, new culture, new venues and new challenges and legalities and so on. Is the growers, because we're dealing with, like you say, you know, they're big personalities or you know, highly individual. Some of them don't even really want to be on their computer and answer emails. So there's a lot of work which is involved, you know, with trying to help growers, you know, get their samples across, giving us all the information, because, you know, we are a pain in their backside a lot of the time, because we want analysis for all their cuvées. Some people don't do it, so they have to get analysis done. There's a lot of paperwork involved in coming to the fair. They have to be motivated, you know, to come to and be part of it. And that takes a lot of headspace, particularly when then you work across, you know, two and now three events. But apart from that, you know, what's really amazing with the fair, with Raw Wine Fair, is to hear the stories of, you know, how they meet people, how they make connections. I was, you know, a while ago, I went to Moscow and St. Petersburg, and a lot of the wines there had been imported because people came to the fair and they found the growers, and now they've, you know, now they're working with these wines and now they're getting drunk in St. Petersburg. You know, I mean, that is really awesome, you know, to know that actually. And I never actually really hear about that, because there's always so much going on, and they come and they leave. And then when I come back and see them, or I meet people, and they're like, oh, yeah, we met them at Raw Wine Fair. And, you know, for me, that is the greatest achievement, you know, of the fair, is how we really help people connect with, you know, with a much bigger community. you know, and that's really always why it was created. And when you know that it's actually working, you know, then I feel really, really proud and really happy.
Are there a lot of producers who are at this point having trouble finding markets in the natural wine idiom?
Yes, they are, because I think, you know, there is, you know, there's no denying it. I mean, we are looking at a very fashionable niche. And I think some growers have become quite cultish, and people, you know, they get obsessed with, I mean, we're talking about Auvergnat, I think is a very good example of people really getting obsessed with trying to get hold of bottles. And I think sometimes, you know, people forget that actually there is, if you take the time to go and visit, you know, wine fairs, if you take the time and, you know, to go and you know, go out maybe to France if you can, or, you know, there is a wealth of talent out there which is not represented here. And I think, you know, it's always the danger is to just become complacent and just focus on a few names. But actually, there are a lot more people. You know, for example, at Raw, we have probably about 40 growers who are coming who don't have agents, you know, who need support, who need distribution. So, you know, even though we are probably quite saturated and a lot of growers run out of cuvées, there's still, there are more. There are more people out there, more growers.
It seems to me one of the real draws of several wines in the natural wine grouping is that the price was right, especially coming after the 08-09 financial downturn in this country. You saw a lot of movement to Cru Beaujolais, which people had sort of resisted before. They'd been getting Volage, Pinot Noir, and pouring that, and then they couldn't pour it anymore because there was really not a lot of money around. And I think it really propelled a lot of people into this category that maybe they'd been poo-pooing before. At least that's what I saw myself. So as the price goes up with more demand, what are we going to see? Like, as these wines move in the direction of Clos Rougeard or Auvenois or Capilano, where now they're quite known, they're sought after, and they're more expensive, are people going to follow and keep going up?
I guess that's a worry. I mean, there are two aspects to this, because obviously, you know, some of the wines are getting more expensive, and I think you are probably ruling out, you know, some drinkers that maybe initially were following you, but now actually the wines have become, you know, more expensive. It's always a question of knowing actually, you know, also who's making the margin, because yes, maybe some growers are increasing their margin a little bit, but I've heard, you know, of sometimes, you know, the middle people are adding more margin because the wine is so famous and so rare that actually then now they can get away with charging a lot more for the wine. So it's also where is the increase coming from? You know, on the other hand, I do believe that a lot of these growers undercharge for their work, and the money they charge for that bottle of wine is not representative of the amount of work. And a lot of them are actually struggling in terms of being able to cover their costs and, you know, grow or maybe buy a bit more land or pay back the debt. So, you know, I think that the question is, what is the fair price for a bottle of wine? You know, actually, are we maybe used to having wine as a commodity for $5? You know, because there are wines that you can maybe produce for $5 because you produce 2 million bottles. So it almost seems to me like they're more than just one wine. You know, we put everything under the same category. But I from seeing how the, you know, how they live, how much of a struggle it is, I think a lot of them undercharge for their work, clearly, because they cannot survive, you know, doing what they do. You know, you're seeing some growers who really are struggling. So it also, like, you know, are we charging too little for wine? I mean, it's like food. You know, if food wasn't subsidized so heavily, you'd be like the same model as you're in Norway, where it's very expensive to just buy a bag of potatoes because it's not subsidized. So I think it's also the for me that's also you know, an interesting question, is just to look at what is a fair price for a bottle of wine made like this, you know, where people are, you know, doing everything by hand, low yields, continuously, you know, watching over it, and, you know, making, you know, high quality stuff, which is very high, you know, demanding. You know, how much is that worth?
So when I look around the world, sometimes I see areas that are real hotbeds of natural wine, at least so it seems to me from afar, and others that are not at all. And I suppose there's probably multiple reasons for that. That could be legislative, it could be the local market, it could be climate conditions. But is there a set of factors that are really important for developing a natural wine scene in a place? Or in other words, are there some places where it's just not going to work out because some of the prereqs are not there? Or are there some places that could really come forward in this idiom that maybe haven't yet for some reason?
For example, if you look at places in Eastern Central Europe, you know, you have, it is changing a little bit, but it's really amazing to see that you have, Hungary or Slovenia, where you have beautiful terroir, where you have, you know, very old vineyards, where you have very specific indigenous, interesting grape varieties. But because of obviously, you know, history and political situation and certain regimes have kind of like really sort of crushed a lot of the tradition and a lot of the knowledge. People have kind of lost a lot of the know-how, and they're now beginning to rediscover that. So I think there is, you know, for me, an area I go over to a lot and I'm keeping an eye on is are these countries, because, you know, if you look at certain vineyards in Slovenia or rather maybe Serbia, you know, you have such a tremendous potential on the ground. You don't really have that much of a know-how quite yet because they kind of forgot what it was like to make, you know, quality wine, you know, because of communism or other. And also there's no demand for it. So they're in this situation where they've got this tremendous potential on the ground. There's no demand for quality wine. There's definitely no demand for natural wine because actually, by law, you cannot get a bottle out if it's slightly cloudy, or you have to, you know, filter it and find it and so on. So they're in this predicament where actually it's incredibly difficult, even if you wanted to, you know, make a natural wine. But it is changing, and I think the demand is growing, and you know, there is places in Slovakia, for example, where you're getting more and more really interesting wines coming out of there. For example, so I think, you know, it is changing, but there are places that are really challenged because even if they really want to, there's no one to buy the wines anyway, you know, so that's an interesting, interesting part of Europe.
What do you think the appeal is amongst the French for natural wine, like at the consumer level? Why is it taken off so well there?
Has it been driven by also a really budget, you know, really great food scene? People... You know, I think if you really are into food, into your ingredients, you know, the natural progression will be to look into, you know, the wine scene, and I think they go hand in hand. And maybe this explosion of really good places to eat has brought along people who are really into natural wines, and that's kind of, you know, brought together a much bigger picture. You know, for sure in London, the natural wine scene has been driven by the food scene, where we are seeing a lot more. You know, young chefs rediscovering British cuisine, focusing on very simple ingredients, but focusing on proper farming and sourcing, you know, great stuff. They've got interested in natural wine, and they're bringing, you know, natural wines onto their list. So I think they are very, very, very well connected. And in fact, I think, you know, if you're traveling, if I want to know where to eat, I always look out for a natural winist because, you know, most of the time a natural winist is going to bring a good kitchen. They really go together, I think.
Where do you see the natural wine scene moving in the future?
So I think, you know, natural wine will just establish itself but will remain a niche category. I don't see it as, you know, growing hugely because, you know, the very nature of what it is. You know, I will see, you know, what I would like to see is some form of definition, some form of understanding in terms of what is a natural wine. So people cannot, you know, use this word sort of, you know, as they please just because it sounds great. And maybe it's not natural, but maybe it's something else. The biggest reason why I created Raw and why I do what I do is I feel that the at the moment, people who drink wine do not get a choice in terms of what they're drinking. You know, I don't like the fact that there's zero transparency in the wine world. I think that, you know, I'm really clear that people need to farm organically. We don't need wine to feed the world. There's no reason why we should be polluting the planet just to produce wine. So I think that is, you know, I'm quite, you know, I can be quite militant about organics, you know, in a way that I'm not about a lot of other stuff, but I think organic is really important. What people do in the cellar, I actually really don't care. And I have no, you know, I'm clear about what I like drinking. If people want to use yeast and sulfites and all sorts of gadgetries and, you know, equipment to do exactly what they want, I think that that's their prerogative and they should just do that. My issue is that we don't know of what is going on. It's quite shocking that, you know, wine is something you ingest in your body and actually you have no way of knowing what went on in the winery. And in a way, I think when we achieve transparency, maybe there's not going to be any need for a word like natural wine, you know, because it'll just be wine. And then you'll be able to actually choose, you know, oh, I'm not going to drink this because they've added this, this and this. So maybe we don't need all this, you know, trying to, you know, establish this category or whatever, because in a way then it will be, maybe it will be irrelevant. You know, I think for me the big challenge right now is to promote transparency, full disclosure of what went on in the winery. This is not going to come from the wine industry. It's not going to be coming from people making wine. You know, I think the lobbying is too big. It's going to have to come from people who drink wine. And I think this is really what needs to happen next, is people really need to start asking questions. They need to understand that, you know, there are several types of wines and they need to be able to freely decide, I'm going to be spending $20 on this because this is what I want to be drinking. You know, that for me, that is the big thing. I actually really don't care what people do.
Isabelle Legrand of the Natural Wine Book and also the Raw Wine Fair has taken a discussion that she had in her own family home and brought it across the world. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Isabelle Legrand of Natural Wine and also the Raw Wine Fair. Before we go, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett, who wrote and performed our new intro music. Go to robmoose.com, that's Rob Moose with two O's, .com for more information about a very talented musician. Of course, we couldn't do what we do here without the help of Erin Skella, who does the warm-up segments for this show. You can find her own blog at thinking-drinking.com. And Aldo Yarrow's excellent website, vinography.com, V-I-N-O-G-R-A-P-H-Y, posts up write-ups and warm-ups for this show, as well as other tremendous content. We are proud to partner with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan for our wine club, offering regularly discounted wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com, levy with an I, openswine@gmail.com, to find out about joining our wine club. And thanks to the many of you who have already signed up. Also, thanks to all of you, our audience. Together we have heard from some of the most fascinating people in wine, and they opened up their hearts and their minds to you and me. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page. Find it by searching at Drink to That Pod. You can also find us on Twitter at Drink to That Pod, or you can check out the pictures on Instagram at Levy Opens Wine. We love iTunes comments, and we love iTunes subscribers. If you subscribe, you'll see our episodes in your feed much earlier, sometimes even as much as a day or two earlier than you would otherwise, and you'll be able to listen to every episode since number one. That's about 400 episodes since we first got started. If you have an Android phone, you'll be happy to know that we're on Google Play Music as well. Our own website is alldrinktothatpod.com, I-L-L with no apostrophe, drinktothatpod.com, and you can find information there about buying a fancy IDTT t-shirt or a seasonally appropriate hoodie. You can also get information on the website about donating to this show. Donations have really kept this thing going, and you can help do that. Thank you, and see you next episode.